Dartmouth Night, 1953. In Hanover, we're gathered on the lawn in front of Dartmouth Hall, while throughout the world, Dartmouth men in twos and tens and hundreds are meeting. Meeting to share a fellowship that links us, man to man, through 184 years to those few who set the foundation. Today, our walls are high and strong, but the weather vane atop our tower is a constant reminder of the day when moccasined feet stirred restlessly in the hills. Our history is always with us. In a real sense, it is our strength. Each year at Dartmouth Night, we rededicate the spirit that founded the College in the Wilderness. Each Dartmouth year is a page of history, and last year can stand with the most significant. In undergraduate matters, we may look back on a year of fine accomplishment with the work of the Undergraduate Council coming into its own by demonstrating the maturity of young men who are capable of handling their own affairs. Last year, Dartmouth men received many graduate awards, and seldom in any graduating class have we had so many outstanding scholars. From the work of the Dartmouth to the interfraternity play contests, extracurricular activity set standards to be emulated. On a positive note of strength, the college received over $2 million in gifts for the third best year in its history, with the all-time record-breaking alumni fund of more than $670,000. Major curricular developments last year were the start of work in human relations and the important program of Northern Studies. In the area of keeping Dartmouth's fine physical plant up to date, an artificial freezing system has been installed in Davis Hockey Rink, and sweeping changes have been made to modernize the lighting of Baker Library. On the athletic fields, Dartmouth's teams showed steady progress and hopes are high, especially in basketball and football, where a group of sophomores is expected to have a good many backs go tearing into opposition end zones. Last year, for the first time, the college published a booklet of President Dickey's speeches, and the president traveled almost 10,000 miles on a favorite mission of meeting with Dartmouth men. Early last spring, the campus buzzed with a rumor that Dartmouth could look forward to one of the largest commencements in its history. Was it true that President Eisenhower would receive an honorary degree? For a long while, literally no one knew for certain. And then word came from the White House, and the whole college was swept into the activity of preparation. Our natural amphitheater, the Bema, had been the commencement site since the 30s, but for an audience estimated at 10,000, it would be inadequate. Baker Library lawn was selected, and plans made in every detail, with an alternate set ready in case of a downpour. At the airport a few weeks later, they checked the latest weather report while waiting for the president and his party. The report said rain, rain, and more rain. President Eisenhower came out of the plane first to greet President Dickey, followed by his assistant, Sherman Adams, class of 1920, who would also receive an honorary degree. The three rode in the rear of President Eisenhower's open car on the way through West Lebanon to Hanover. People crowded the side of the road, and finally, when the motorcade entered Hanover, it slowed to a walk and wedged its way through the throng. One Secret Service agent said that he had seen nothing like it since the election. Everyone on Main Street that day felt that the president had received the town's best greeting. The first thing most of Hanover did on Sunday morning, June 14th, was to go to the window and look up. The weatherman had been wrong, never more wrong. Even allowing for the vagaries of our weather, it just wasn't possible to have rain from a cloudless sky. The presidents had stayed together in President Dickey's house, and after a session with the photographers in front of the administration building, the commencement procession started. It went south on Main Street to McNutt Hall and over to the center of the campus, and then straight down the middle aisle to the platform. Everyone stood, every head turned, as President Eisenhower, walking next to President Emeritus Ernest Martin Hopkins, went to the platform. At the end of the exercises, after a fine address by Canada's Minister for External Affairs, Lester B. Pearson, Dean of the Faculty, Donald H. Morrison, stepped to the microphone and said,
"For the honorary degree of Doctor of Laws, Dwight David Eisenhower."
Mr. President, in 1952, you were a relatively innocent bystander at a new discovery of awesome portent for American political geography, establishing that the high road from Texas via Kansas to Washington runs plumb through New Hampshire. The eminence of the presidency precludes the bestowal of greater honor, and all too often fends off even those words of encouragement and gentle praise on which each man's life is somewhat borne forward. May we not, however, mark this historic Dartmouth Day with these few words for your remembering. No great captain ever gave to free men everywhere such confidence in the reality of their collective strength for the common defense of God's peace. To you who have given us this and more, our appreciation paradoxically is best expressed by the quality of what we ask for tomorrow. That, sir, in daily deed, is the measure of the liberating arts we here profess. In this mission, and with your honored acceptance of her Doctorate of Laws, Dartmouth is privileged to plight you her troth.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, there is a small item by way of a dividend which goes with that degree. And Mr. Esperance, the president of the senior class, will present that item. After he has done that, the president will address us informally.
I'd like to present to you President Eisenhower, on behalf of the class of 1953, this senior cane, the traditional symbol of Dartmouth friendship.
Thank you very much.
President Dickey, Secretary Pearson, members of Dartmouth's family and their friends, your president possesses a brash bravery approaching foolhardiness when he gives to me this platform in front of such an audience with no other admonition except to say, speak informally, and giving me no limits of any other kind. He has forgotten, I think, that old soldiers love to reminisce and are and that they are, in addition, notoriously garrulous. But I have a certain limitations of my own I learned throughout these many years, and I think they will serve to keep me from offending too deeply. But even if I do offend, I beg in advance the pardon of those families and friends, and sweethearts that are waiting to greet these new graduates with a chaste handshake of congratulations, and assure you that any overstaying of my time was unintentional and just merely a product of my past upbringing. First, I could not pass this occasion without the traditional congratulations to this class. The completion of 4 years of arduous work at a college of such standing as Dartmouth, and of which there is no higher. Next, I think I may be pardoned if I congratulate you on the quality of the addresses you have heard today up to this moment. I think that your commencement address and the two valedictory addresses established a standard that could well be one to be emulated even here in the future. Now, with your permission, I want to talk about two qualities today that are purely personal. I'm not going to be an exhorter, as Secretary Pearson has said. I want to talk about these two things and merely suggest to you certain ideas concerning them. I'm going to talk about fun, joy, happiness, just fun in life. I'm going to talk a little about courage. Now, as to fun, to get myself straight at once, for fear that in my garrulous way I might stray from my point, I shall say this. Unless each day can be looked back upon by an individual as one in which he has had some fun, some joy, some real satisfaction, that day is a loss. It is unchristian and wicked, in my opinion, to allow such a thing to occur. Now, there are many, many different things, thoughts, and ideas that will contribute, many acts of your own that will contribute to the fun you have out of life. You go along a bank, stream bank in the tropics, and there is a crocodile lying in the sun. He looks a picture of contentment. They tell me that often they live to be a great age, 100 years and more. They're still lying in the sun, that's all they do. Now, by going to Dartmouth, by coming this far along the road, you have achieved certain standards, and one of those standards is it is no longer so easy for you to have fun. You can't be like a crocodile and sleep away your life and be satisfied. You must do something, and normally it must involve others. Something you do for them. The satisfaction, it's trite, but it's true, the satisfaction of a clear conscience. No matter what happens, you get a lot of fun out of shooting a good game of golf. But you wouldn't have the slightest fun out of it if you knew to achieve that first 79, you broke 80 today. If you did it by teeing up in the rough or taking the slightest advantage anywhere, and no one else in the world but you knew it, that game would never be a 79 to you. And so it wasn't worthwhile because you had no fun doing it. Whatever you do, a little help to someone along the road, something you've achieved because you've worked hard for it, like your graduation diploma today, those things have become worthwhile. In your own estimation, will contribute to your happiness. They will measure up to your standards because your standards have become those that only you know. But they have become very high. And if you do those things, they are the kind of things that will satisfy you and make life something that is joyous, that will cause your face to spread out a little instead of drawing up this way, and there's too much of that in the world anyway. You are leaders. You're bound to be leaders. You've had advantages that... ones have to have confidence. You've got to help give it to them. And this brings me up to my second little topic, which is courage. I forget the author, but one many years ago, you know, uttered that famous saying, "The coward dies a thousand deaths. The brave man dies but once." In other words, you can live happily if you have courage because you are not fearing something that you can't help. You must have courage to look at all about you with honest eyes. Above all, yourself. And we go back to our standards. Have you actually measured up? If you have, it's that courage to look at yourself and say, well, I failed miserably there. I hurt someone's feelings needlessly. I lost my temper, which you must never do except deliberately. You didn't measure up to your own standards. Now, if you have the courage to look at yourself, soon you begin to achieve a code or a pattern that is closer to your own standards. By the same token, look at all that is dear to you, your own family. Of course, your children are going to be the greatest, the most extraordinary that ever lived, but also look at them as they are occasionally. Look at your country. Here's a country of which we are proud, as you are proud of Dartmouth and all about you and the family to which you belong. But this country is a long way from perfection. A long way. We have the disgrace of racial discrimination. Or we have prejudice against people because of their religion. We have crime on the docks. We have not had the courage to uproot these things, although we know they are wrong. And we, with our standards, the standards given us at places like Dartmouth, we know they're wrong. Now, that courage is not going to be satisfied. Your sense of satisfaction is not going to be satisfied if you haven't the courage to look at these things and do your best to help correct them. Because that is the contribution you shall make to this beloved country in your time. Each of us, as he passes along, should strive to add something. It isn't enough merely to say, "I love America," and to salute the flag and take off your hat as it goes by, and to help sing the Star-Spangled Banner. Wonderful. We love to do them. And our hearts swell with pride because those who went before you worked to give to us today, standing here, this pride. And this is a pride in an institution that we think has brought great happiness and we know has brought great contentment and freedom of soul to many people. But it's not yet done. You must add to it. Don't join the book burners. Don't think you're going to conceal faults by concealing evidence that they ever existed. Don't be afraid to go in your library and read every book, as long as any document does not offend our own ideas and of decency. That should be the only censorship. How will we defeat communism unless we know what it is, what it teaches, and why does it have such an appeal for men? Why are so many people swearing allegiance to it? It's almost a religion, albeit one of the nether regions. And we have got to fight it with something better, not try to conceal the thinking of our own people. They are part of America. And even if they think ideas that are contrary to ours, their right to say them, their right to record them, and their right to have them at places where they're accessible to others is unquestioned, or it's not America. I fear I've already violated my promise not to stay too long and not to exhort. I could not, though, go back to my chair without saying that my sense of distinction in Dartmouth's honorary doctorate in the overgenerous, extravagantly overgenerous remarks of your president in awarding me that doctorate, in the presence of this king, from the young men of the graduating class. All of these things are very precious to me. I have been fortunate in that my life has been spent with America's young men, probably one of the finest things that has happened to me in a very long life. I thank you again for this award.
The president of the college, John Sloan Dickey.
The words we have just heard were spoken by the American president informally and extemporaneously. They were not the commencement address, but the spontaneous response of an honored participant in one of Dartmouth's finest days. The spirit of such words can never be wholly caught or kept on the printed page, but this recording lives with the vibrant feel of the moment itself. An experienced metropolitan newspaper man reported that President Eisenhower was never more impressive, never more himself than he was on this occasion. We can truly say he was a relaxed, happy man who more than once remarked, "This is the way a college ought to look." The president's words have already become a historic part of the homespun fabric of American freedom. They have had their impact on the nation and, in truth, around the girdled earth. And yet, over the long years of the future, I think they may well be best remembered as a fresh, bright strand in the story of Dartmouth. Whatever the hour and the circumstance, I am sure the day will never come on Hanover Plain when these words of the American president will not be powerfully invoked to answer any challenge in the life of this college to the right of her men to inquire and to know. They are imperishably a part of the Dartmouth heritage, and thereby always they will be a part of the living Dartmouth. On this Dartmouth night, on the campus and the world around, the enduring challenge is to be not merely men of Dartmouth, but men worthy of Dartmouth.
Men of Dartmouth, give a rouse for the college on the hill. Give a rouse, give a rouse with a will. For the sons of old Dartmouth, the sturdy sons of Dartmouth, though round the girdled earth a wronger spell on them remains, they have the still north in their hearts, the hill winds in their veins, and the granite of New Hampshire in their muscles. And the granite of New Hampshire in their muscles and their brains.
Your announcer has been Norman R. Bander, class of 1954.